Dad deserves double the thanks this year. So this Father's Day, give him the power tool system that has everything for every job. The Ryobi One Plus tool system now on special buy. Over 260 Ryobi tools powered by one interchangeable 18-volt battery. And for a limited time, when you make a qualifying Ryobi purchase, you get one select tool or battery free. Feels like Father's Day at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Offer valid through July 31st, 2022. Valid at participating stores and online. Limit one per transaction.
Welcome to The Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Primary elections continue. In California, they vote successfully to recall a radical district attorney in San Francisco.
Voters choosing to recall San Francisco District Attorney Chesa Boudin.
We'll look at this trend amongst DAs.
Let's just understand what's at stake here. What's at stake is the rule of law.
We'll get a clear-eyed look at the legal landscape if, in fact, Roe v. Wade is overturned.
The pro-abortion politicians and all the activists are channeling Chicken Little, saying that if Roe v. Wade is overturned, thousands of women will die.
You've heard it over and over again now. June is Pride Month. We'll get wisdom for families on how to handle it with Jeff Johnston, a Focus on the Family.
Protect your kids as much as possible.
And a slaughter of 50-plus Christians in Nigeria.
Gunmen with explosives stormed a Catholic church and opened fire.
We've got all this and more. I'm Kevin McCullough, your host, coming to you from my home station in New York City, where you can hear my own program live each weekday afternoon on AM 570 The Mission and AM570TheMission.com. Take a moment to follow Christian Outlook on Twitter at TC Outlook. That's TC Outlook. You can follow me on Instagram at KMC Radio. Great to be with you. We'll begin with our elections. Primary elections continue. Seven states, including California, held elections on Tuesday. Included for those in the Bay Area, the effort to recall the radical district attorney Chesa Boudin succeeded, and it wasn't even close. 60% of voters chose to recall this son of two convicted terrorists.
People are angry. They're frustrated. And I want to be very clear about what happened tonight. The right-wing billionaires outspent us 3-1. They exploited an environment in which people are appropriately upset.
But San Francisco is not alone. We're seeing a trend of leading prosecutors that, simply put, are putting themselves above the law. What's at stake is something much more profound than an unprosecuted crime here and there. Albert Mohler took a closer look at what is happening in Virginia from his Briefing podcast.
What we're going to look at today is the state of Virginia, where in the state of Virginia, the Commonwealth attorney, whose name is Steve Toscano, has announced that he is not going to prosecute abortion crimes if indeed abortion becomes a crime. In particular, he says, as the headline in the New York Times reveals, quote, "My governor can pass bad abortion laws, but I won't enforce them," end quote. This is the result of a very long march through the law schools and through legal institutions undertaken by those who, applying what has been known as critical legal studies and other liberal and progressive ideologies, what they have argued is a progressive understanding of the law, the function of lawyers, and in particular, the function of prosecutors. And the revolutionary issue here is the widespread argument that prosecutors should not prosecute crimes when they think there's a disparate kind of effect or they just don't like the laws themselves. Now, let's just state the obvious. Our rule of law, our constitutional order, comes down to requiring constitutional officers to fulfill their responsibility. But what you have right now is a divide in this country that is so deep that you have legal theorists and you have law professors in law schools turning out lawyers who actually are saying right up front they don't intend to apply the law, at least the law as is written. Here you have a Commonwealth attorney saying that he will not prosecute what he describes as bad abortion laws, even if the state should adopt them. Now, before we even turn to the case in Virginia, the particular argument, we need to understand how critical legal studies has worked. Critical legal studies is just one of the first and most important of the offshoots of critical theory. Critical legal studies emerged in law schools with the argument that the law, and that means not only legal statutes, but the entire system of laws, is an embedded exercise in discrimination and oppression. So instead, critical legal studies said you need to look not at the law, but at the oppression that might be represented by the law, and you should seek to transform the law. And if you can't transform the law through the legislative process, then you put in place legal authority, such as prosecuting attorneys, who will actually decide which laws they will enforce, which crimes they will prosecute. And one of the interesting things you see right now is this rise of an entire movement of very progressive prosecutors who are mainly known for what they will not prosecute, or you might even say who they will not prosecute. Steve Descano, in the role of Commonwealth Attorney there in the Commonwealth of Virginia, has written this article. As I said, the title was, "My Governor Can Pass Bad Abortion Laws, But I Won't Enforce Them." And, of course, the background of this is the election of Glenn Youngkin as the governor of Virginia. And now the Commonwealth Attorney says, quote, "Almost 2.5 years ago, I took my oath of office as prosecutor and swore to protect my community from those who broke the law. The real threat," he says, "I now realize may stem from those who write the law," end quote. Now, even if we didn't go any further, let's just understand what's at stake here. What's at stake is the rule of law. Here you have a legal officer saying that his judgment is above the judgment of the court. His judgment is above the legislature and the governor there in Virginia. He is a law unto himself. He says, quote, "If the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade, the rights of thousands of Virginia women will be thrown into question. While the Commonwealth does not have an abortion ban on the books," he writes, "our governor has said that he is staunchly, unabashedly against abortion and fully committed to going on the offense," that's quoting the governor, "against abortion rights in our legislature." The prosecutor then writes, quote, "Should Roe fall, he could well strip women of their reproductive rights and go after thousands more who flock to the state whenever neighboring jurisdictions clamp down on abortion access. What's more," he writes, "in Virginia today, women who are suspected of terminating a pregnancy without the assistance of a certified medical professional can face felony charges if they miscarry," end quote. Now, you'll notice a shift in his argument. It was quite subtle. I don't think he meant for us to catch it. But in that last part, he's not arguing against a law that has not yet been adopted. He's actually saying that he won't prosecute the law currently on the books in the Commonwealth of Virginia. His argument goes from bad to worse. He writes this, quote, "So when the courts," that means the Supreme Court's draft decision overturning Roe v. Wade, "was leaked earlier this month, I committed to never prosecute a woman for making her own health care decisions." Notice the language there. Abortion just all of a sudden appears in the first part of his argument. It disappears when he says he's not going to prosecute. Now it is, quote, "a woman making her own health care decisions." He continued, quote, "That means that no matter what the law in Virginia says, I will not prosecute a woman for having an abortion or for being suspected of inducing one," end quote. Notice the audacity here. Rarely do you see this level of absolute upfront statement from a legal officer that he will not apply the law if he doesn't like the law. I go back to his sentence. He said, "That means that no matter what the law in Virginia says, I will not prosecute a woman for having an abortion or for being suspected of inducing one," end quote. In this manifesto that he wrote as a candidate, he wrote about how he would apply prosecutorial discretion. He says that that gives the prosecutor discretion over whether to accept or reject a case, the charges to bring in a case the office has accepted, whether to prosecute or seek alternatives to prosecution, bail policies, plea officers, types of sentences to seek. In every one of those points, he aims in a very liberal direction. He means, and he said ahead of time, he means to apply prosecutorial discretion in such a way that he basically would use that discretion, as he calls it, in order to avoid applying the law, to avoid prosecuting some criminals. He raises issues such as marijuana, certain kinds of drug use, felony, larceny threshold, cash bail. He's against the death penalty. No great surprise there. He said, quote, "I will not seek the death penalty, period, full stop. The death penalty does not deter crime and is no more effective than life sentences at keeping the most dangerous individuals out of our communities," end quote. Now, I reject that argument, but something else is at stake here. If you notice, most of these so-called progressive prosecutors, they're not much for life in prison either. Christians need to take this kind of argument very seriously. We need to understand that indeed we are committed to the rule of law, and that's not just a matter of historical pattern or just some kind of ideological convenience. We actually believe that human dignity, the sanctity of human life, the flourishing and furthering of human society depends upon the rule of law. When you have legal officials saying up front, and now in this article in the New York Times, that they will not prosecute what the law declares to be crimes, well, you no longer have a rule of law. You have a rule of progressive prosecutors.
The nation continues to watch the Supreme Court in anticipation of their decision in the Dobbs case, the decision that would overturn Roe v. Wade. That is, if they release a decision along the lines of what was leaked in recent weeks. The radical elements in the pro-abortion crowd are clearly activated. An armed man was arrested near the home of Justice Kavanaugh on Wednesday and charged with attempted murder. Bradley Mattis has been watching the doomsday rhetoric of the abortion lobby. He was a guest on my program. I should note that we spoke before the threat on Justice Kavanaugh's life.
Chicken Little! What is it? What's going on?
The sky is falling! The sky is falling!
The sky is falling!
Are you crazy?
Let's just go over some of the fundamentals. Why would people be inclined to think that the sky is falling if America suddenly becomes post-Roe?
The pro-abortion politicians and all the activists are channeling Chicken Little, saying that if Roe v. Wade is overturned, thousands of women will die. There will be economic chaos and all kinds of problems. Many people believe, based on a recent poll done by Rasmussen, 77% believe that if Roe is overturned, all abortion ends in America. And that's not true. What actually happens is that we go back to the pre-Roe v. Wade days in 1973, where the important issue of abortion can be discussed and decided, voted upon, and laws enacted on the local government level. If you have a pro-life state legislature and governor, you can expect to see probably some swift action to protect unborn babies and their mothers. There are about 21 states that, after Roe is reversed, will significantly or totally stop abortion. And then, Kevin, there's another 9 states, one of which I am in Florida, where we have a pro-life legislature and governor. And with some activity, passing of legislation, we can do some serious protection of Florida's unborn babies. So that totals up to 30 different states that will significantly or totally end abortion and the bloodletting should Roe be overturned, and we believe it will be.
Why are you making the case that the sky isn't falling once Roe v. Wade is overturned?
Well, one of the things that we want to stress is that women will benefit without access to abortion. And one of my guests is a young woman who had 2 children. Her car was repossessed. She lost her job. She was about a few days from being homeless and found out she was pregnant. But in Texas, with the Texas Heartbeat Act, she could not access abortion. She was, of course, very upset. But then she crossed paths with a pregnancy help center in Houston, and they just came around her and gave her support, got her everything that she needed, and equipped her to say yes to life. And, you know, she's getting, Kenya is her name, and she's getting her life back in order. She's got a job. She has a new car, new for her, and things are really going well. And she is now so grateful that she could not have that abortion. We also are going to compare America's extreme abortion laws of allowing abortion throughout pregnancy for any reason with the rest of the world. And part of that, of course, is the fact that legislators don't want to pass legislation. The courts are only going to slap them down and say, you can't do that. With the reversal of Roe, that opens everything up to what states want to do to protect their most precious natural resource, that being unborn babies.
Coming up, Pride Month.
Protect your kids as much as possible.
When the Christian Outlook continues in a moment.
The Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy believes in the calling to politics and public service. As one of the few programs of its kind based at a leading Christian university, we prepare students for exciting careers in this vital arena through a curriculum that combines rigorous study of America's founding principles with the latest tools of policy analysis. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun, so find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. I'd be surprised if you missed it thus far, but June is Pride Month, and the celebrations of all things LGBTQ are everywhere. Sporting events, military recognitions, parades, television specials. Families need wisdom in how to navigate it all. Georgine Rice turned to Jeff Johnston of Focus on the Family from KPDQ in Portland.
You know, I don't typically watch a lot of television. I was watching an innocuous station. It was one of the, you know, kind of the home stations. It happens to be part of the Discovery Network. And literally every commercial focused on the month as Pride Month and went into great detail and specifics about the kind of programming that was coming. Some of it was shocking to me. It seemed wholly inappropriate. But you can't escape the month that we're in. And how do we navigate all of this, particularly when we have children in the home?
No, you're right. It's everywhere. It's in corporations. It's in education, arts and entertainment, media, and social media. And so parents need to be prepared. And what we suggest at Focus on the Family is, first of all, that parents lay a solid foundation with their children about God's good design for marriage and sexuality and relationships. Now, this doesn't mean that you're talking to your little four-year-old about sex, but it does mean that you're talking to your little four-year-old about how God made boys and girls. And both of those are good, and both are made in God's image, but they're different from each other. And if you have a little girl, you affirm her as a girl and say, it's wonderful that God made you a girl. And you have a little boy, you say, God made you masculine, and that's a good thing. And, you know, it's not just parents. It's Sunday school teachers, grandparents, church leaders. This needs to be coming from the church as well, that God made us male and female. And then the second thing you teach your kids is, what is marriage? Marriage brings together a mommy and a daddy. And again, you're not talking about sex at all. You're talking very basically about God's good design for marriage and how marriage leads to family and children. And those are all good things created by God. And so we start with that foundation. And then I think you can talk to your kids about how, of course, people sin and they make mistakes and there are people we disagree with and who do things that aren't good. We still want to love those people and respect them, but it's okay to disagree with them. And I think that gives you a solid foundation for when your kids then start to encounter LGBT issues.
I know for a lot of parents, it may be surprising to learn that very young children are being exposed and specifically targeted to provide information that is going to indoctrinate them into a worldview that would reject what you've just described. I noted a couple of headlines just from the last day or two. One in Texas, where they've introduced a bill that bans children from drag shows after the Drag the Kids to Pride event. And some of the details are entirely inappropriate that I wouldn't even repeat on the air. There were some protesters who showed up, but this was an event billed as a family-friendly drag show. A spinoff of their champagne drag brunch that would allow kids to dance with performers on stage. And I won't quote some of the signs that were visible to kids. And then Mattel, just this last week, they've created a transgender Barbie. I'm not sure how you tell a Barbie is transgender, and I don't really want to think too deeply about that. But the doll is formed in the likeness of actor Laverne Cox, a biological male who identifies as a female. And these are targeted specifically for children. And these are just two examples. We're not even going into what some are suggesting is appropriate for kids in kindergarten on up. What's happening in culture and in schools that's prompting this kind of concern and pushing this kind of agenda?
This is something that has been developing slowly over time, and it didn't start with the LGBT community. This started with the sexual revolution and the explosion of pornography and with our divorce culture. And then 50 years ago, with the beginning of the gay pride movement, it's been a slow increase over time. You know, this started as one parade in New York City on one day, and then it spread to other cities, and then it became a week of celebrations and festivals, and then it became a whole month. And now, to be honest with you, it's year-round. You can find LGBT pride events from January through December in the U.S. and around the world. And they've made inroads into every area. Corporations are graded by the Human Rights Campaign, which is the largest LGBT activist group in the U.S. They're graded on how much they support the LGBT agenda. And there are hundreds of corporations that are supporting gay pride and LGBT issues. So it's been a slow growth over the last 50, 60, 70 years, but then it just has accelerated recently. I think the Obergefell decision legalizing same-sex marriage, Bruce Jenner announcing his transition from, so-called transition from male to female, all those things have accelerated these issues, and now we're just seeing it every place. And kids are being exposed on cartoons, on television shows, library books. There was a story today about Pizza Hut having a reading program, and the books they're recommending for June are three LGBT pride books. So it is everywhere. And we encourage parents, you know, protect your kids as much as possible. Kids don't need to be confused and sexualized when they're very young. It's not healthy. It's damaging. It arouses their sexuality and their curiosity much too early, and it's confusing for them.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, we want to teach them God's good truth, you know, that he made them male and female and what his design for marriage is.
The hostility that the Christian in our nation is facing today is growing and is real, but it is not at all like the violence and hostility facing our Christian brothers and sisters elsewhere on the planet. Don Crow looks at the horrific massacre of Christians last week in Nigeria from his program on WAVA in our nation's capital.
I'm sure many of you who track these things, I wish more did. I mean, nationally and across the secular media especially, but also even the religious media, I wish more would pay attention to what's been happening to our brothers and sisters in Nigeria. But it seems to be a rather lonely topic for much of the nation and many, many Christians in our country. Here's the headline: over 50 killed in vile and satanic attack at Nigerian church on Pentecost Sunday. Gunmen with explosives stormed a Catholic church and opened fire in southwest Nigeria on June 5th, killing many worshipers, wounding others, according to government and police. The violence at St. Francis Catholic Church in Owo Town in Ondo State erupted during the morning service in a rare attack in the southwest of Nigeria. Now, if you track this at all, or you've heard us talk about it, and we do try to talk about it frequently here on the show, you know most of the violence and killing and slaughter of innocent people, primarily Christians and even moderate Muslims who will not buy into the radical agenda, is happening up in the northern tier of Nigeria and over to the north and northeast. But this is in the southwest. Gunsmen suspected to be Islamic Fulani herdsmen barged into a Catholic church in southwestern Nigeria, opened fire, and detonated explosives while the congregation was celebrating Mass on Pentecost Sunday, killing at least 50 worshipers, including women and children. And it's feared also that some Christians were abducted after the attack was finished. After the gunman stopped shooting and the aftermath of the explosions was visible at St. Francis Catholic Church, this is a quote, it was a gory sight as dead bodies, both old and young, mostly women and children, littered the church. This according to the Nigerian daily The Guardian. Some bodies were dismembered with internal organs splashed on the temple grounds. And it goes on. I don't need to paint the picture any more graphically. You already got it, I'm sure. But what we're saying here is, we say, well, what do we do about that? Well, pray for those in Nigeria and other parts of the world who are paying such a high and a growing price for their faith. Pray for them, for their courage, their strength, their protection.
Coming up, dealing with disinformation.
Truth is so strong that a free market for ideas, it'll win out.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. In just 10 minutes, I can zip through 10 stories that help me start my day and help shape where I go with the Mike Gallagher Show. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Kevin McCullough. In recent days, the Biden administration got widespread and well-deserved condemnation upon their announcement of a disinformation governance board. It struck anyone with even a bit of familiarity with George Orwell as eerily similar to his own Ministry of Truth from Orwell's famous book 1984. The administration has put their plans on hold for now, but the ideas you just watch will be back. Here's Jerry Boyer, a member of Salem Media's editorial board, with John Hall and Kathy Emmons on Word 101.5 FM in Pittsburgh.
Talk to us about online truth monitoring in general and Elon Musk.
Well, I don't trust online truth monitoring. Mm-hmm. I believe in truth. I think truth is a real thing. But I'm influenced by the Puritan poet John Milton, who wrote Paradise Lost. But he also wrote an essay called Areopagitica, in which he argued that truth is so strong that a free market for ideas, it'll win out. Let it go out there and fight for itself.
Let it be let loose, he said, right?
Yes, exactly. I think that serves us well. Also the issue is when you have people who are arbiters of truth, that's fine if they have a commitment to truth. But the people who will become arbiters of truth will inevitably tend to be not people who are committed to truth, but people who are good at accumulating power. And I don't think there's actually much correlation between the skill set of accumulating truth and the skill set of accumulating power. Mm-hmm. So bureaucrats get themselves into positions where they accumulate power and then they decide what truth is. But what happens is they really are aligned with other power bases. We would like you to tell us, when you have adopted a policy of removing content from your platform because some government agency requested it, not because it was a legal requirement, if the CDC said to you, we don't want anything on out there that questions the efficacy of vaccines, we want you to disclose that to us as shareholders, because we want to know when you're following power. I don't want some curator at Twitter to be told by some bureaucrat what I'm allowed to hear or what I'm allowed to read. I'm with John Milton. And you know what? If we're babies, we really can't handle it and we're not going to be able to find our way to truth. Okay, well, better start growing up now. And we're not going to grow up unless we hear all of these things and are forced to have to evaluate them. I understand there's a lot of junk on the internet, but I think that creating a kind of ministry of truth will not decrease the amount of junk on the internet. I think it'll just mean there's only one kind of junk rather than several kinds of junk. And I think it will infantilize us. For a lot of people, it'll be, well, if it's here, I can trust it. And it'll also create a group of radicals who are ready to believe every crackpot theory because the fact that they're suppressing it must mean it's true. As opposed to everybody go out there, make our argument. Even God said, come, let us reason together. If there'd be anybody who would have the authority to say, shut up and listen to me, I'm just going to tell you how it is. Omnipotence and omniscience himself says, I'm going to reason with you. Well, if God puts himself in a position where he feels that it's his obligation to reason with us, that's the way he wants to get his point across, then I think that the folks at Twitter ought to, they shouldn't put themselves above God in that position.
Right.
They should allow everybody to reason things together and we'll have to grow through it. And yeah, there'll be a lot of junk out there. I mean, that's life for grownups.
That's how it is. So then presuppose then that the deal that Elon Musk does buy Twitter, is this a good deal for us who love free speech, having Elon Musk buy Twitter?
Yes. Assuming that, I wouldn't assume it. The stock price indicates he won't do it. So whether he buys it, takes it private and makes it a free speech platform, or whether he intimidates them so much that they have to open up control, or whether he discredits it so much that nobody believes it anymore, it really does amount to a diminution of their power to control what we think. So sometimes it takes, Samson's sort of crazy men, out there that in the providence of God tear down the temples. But you can see how his kind of wild man stuff, his kind of chaos stuff. But on the other hand, sometimes a chaos agent can end up breaking things that really do deserve to be broken. You don't necessarily have to buy into their chaos to see that somehow in providence, there's a gift that chaos may wreck the credibility of things that really had too much power.
That's really good.
And then it can be a problem when you buy into the chaos.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
What? That's the problem, right? So you can say, wow, I'm glad that he's taking down this elite group where he's calling them out. But then you kind of like join in emotionally. And there you are chanting lock her up, or you're storming the Capitol building. It's like, oh, hold on a second.
How do we get here?
You don't need to join the madness to recognize that somehow in God's plan, maybe somehow the madness will create us an opportunity for Christians to step in and offer a real alternative rather than a chaos alternative.
That's good.
Coming up, could we really be moving toward the end of Roe?
We need to take a moment and rejoice that we're talking about the overturning of this egregious Roe v. Wade decision in 1973.
When the Christian Outlook continues in a moment. Stay with us.
The Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy believes in the calling to politics and public service. As one of the few programs of its kind based at a leading Christian university, we prepare students for exciting careers in this vital arena through a curriculum that combines rigorous study of America's founding principles with the latest tools of policy analysis. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun, so find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. As we await the release of the Supreme Court's decision on Dobbs, elite media and pro-abortion forces would lead you to believe that this will be the end of the world as we know it. They would have us continue to believe that in 1973, the High Court discerned some hitherto unrecognized right to abortion in the Constitution, and that such an uncovered right simply cannot be tampered with. Actually, of course, there's no mention of abortion at all in the Constitution. But notion of the dignity of the unborn baby was, indeed, part of the conversation at the founding era. Tim Barton of Wall Builders explains. He was a guest of my colleague here in New York, Eric Metaxas.
You can go back through all of the history of time, all of mankind, and you see these examples where there were multiple times, even in biblical history, people were trying to kill the babies they did not want. Now, again, our technology has changed now, but the reason I bring this up is because the founding fathers actually dealt with this even in legal code. James Wilson, who was a signer of the Constitution, a signer of the Declaration, he was actually appointed by George Washington to be an original Supreme Court justice. And then James Wilson wrote the very first law books that were used in America. And his law books, which were used by all the early law students, he explained that under the common law in America, that human life, even unborn human life, is protected by the common law. And their job was to protect the unborn human life. Well, he actually, in his law books, details that there are people that try to end human life, even unborn human life. He says, but in America, we do it different. John Witherspoon followed up very similarly. He was a president at Princeton University. Now, John Witherspoon also was a signer of the Declaration. He was also a pastor at the time he signed. He was a pastor at Princeton, but he was the head of their theological seminary. He was the president at Princeton, and he gave a lecture to his law students where he identified one of the things that made America different from many of the secularized European nations. He said, in America, we have denied the power of life and death to the parents over their children. The parents don't get to decide if their kids live or die. He said, over in Europe, we're seeing parents actually kill their unborn children in America. And so actually, and if you read both their writings, so James Wilson starts with the unborn. He says, with consistency, life from conception to its close is protected by the common law. He says, in the contemplations of law, life begins when the infant is first able to stir in the womb. By the contemplations of law, that life is protected. So James Wilson literally explains in common law, as soon as that infant is able to stir in the womb, that individual is protected. And we could certainly identify now with our technology. We actually can go to the specific week or the day that a child is first able to stir in the womb. It's worth noting back in their time, though, to get the full context, that they're not tracking, right? They don't have the technology to actually see inside and see these images of this unborn child. And so they wouldn't know necessarily the woman was pregnant until the infant is able to stir in the womb. And when the infant stirs in the womb, now they know, okay, we have a pregnant person. Right back then, there was no magic stick they could pee on that would have a positive or negative to let a woman know early on. So literally his argument was, as soon as a woman knows she's pregnant, the laws of America protect the life of that unborn child. John Witherspoon, similarly, in his lecture, and the whole lecture is, I mean, as a history nerd, I enjoy it. I don't know that everybody would enjoy
actually,
it, but certainly it's...
Tim, you're just giving us really important, rare information. I've not heard most of this before, but you're talking about how the founders, specifically John Witherspoon of New Jersey, dealt with the issue of abortion. As you said, we tend to think of it as something fairly recent. Of course, it is no more recent than life or birth or death are recent. These are things that have existed since we have existed. So talk about Witherspoon.
Yeah, and let me actually add a little more context to John Witherspoon, because John Witherspoon, as the president of Princeton, he personally trained more founding fathers than any other single individual, and Princeton trained more founding fathers than any other university. So John Witherspoon had a direct influence on dozens and dozens and dozens of individuals that we would consider founding fathers. And this is important to know, because he's imparting his philosophy into them, and certainly you actually see a lot of his ideas coming out and things they did.
Tim, first of all, what is going to happen when Roe v. Wade, praise the Lord, is overturned? There are many people, many of them devout Christians, or they purport to be, who are very negative, depressing people, who say things like, it'll never be overturned. I just want to rebuke those people. If yeah. you say things like that, if you say, no one will ever be held accountable, when you have that negative idea, you're being unbiblical, which is to say you're participating in the evil, whether you know it or not, by that cynical, ultimately nihilistic view. We need to rejoice that in this nation, because of the activism and the prayers and the tremendous sacrifice of literally millions of human beings, we have come to a place where we have justices in the Supreme Court who understand the clear situation of what the Constitution says and doesn't say, and have the guts to rule, to overturn something, which, of course, is a very big deal. So that's a big deal. And we need to celebrate that. We're never done any more than slavery was not abolished in 1807 when Wilberforce succeeded in abolishing the slave trade. They still had decades to go before slavery itself was abolished. So there's always more to do. But we need to take a moment and rejoice that that we're talking about the overturning of this egregious Roe v. Wade decision in 1973. So we want to start there. So we were talking about what happens. You said that there are trigger laws in 27 states, I guess, that would make abortion mostly illegal, but in many of these states, it's still there's still carve out, so to speak.
Yes, sir. There's some places where they have limitations on what the ban is. And so there's 27 states that have passed trigger laws, but some of them are in the opposite direction where they're saying if Roe is overturned, then abortion is legal in our state, is always going to be legal. And this is where it's also interesting, seeing the transition, where if you go back to the Bill Clinton notion from the Democrat Party of abortion, was that it was legal, safe, and rare. And we have now seen the argument shift from safe, rare, to numerous and plentiful and all over the place. There's been a massive shift, and part of that shift, now, to your point, as you identified, we need to make sure we have the right attitude. I think the biblical perspective, that's a great example, is if you go looking at the Israelites when they're about to go into Canaan, and Moses says, hey, let's choose a leader from each of the tribes to go spy out the land, and all of them saw the goodness of the land, but 10 of the leaders came back and said that this problem is too big, it can't be solved, it won't be overturned. It was only Joshua and Caleb who recognized that even though with man this might seem impossible, with God all things are possible. Joshua and Caleb entered into the promised land where everybody else didn't get to recognize the fullness of the blessing.
Coming up, more with Tim Burton.
I do think that God is opening people's eyes. I think it's the foundation of a great awakening.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. It's a look at today's most compelling stories and provides responses from key conservatives in media and politics. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. History, as Tim Burton and Eric Metaxas pointed out in our last segment, has been shaped by those with the courage to push in the direction of what is very clear moral good. That was true in the abolition movement, and it's true, at least in part, on the pro-life movement. Let's pick up a few more minutes with Tim Burton.
Similarly, if you even pointed out with the slavery issue, if you look at the abolition movement in America, it would have been easy in the 1800s if you were anti-slavery in one of the southern states to think, man, you know, this is never going to happen. This is crazy. But the reality is, because there were people willing to roll up their sleeves to get involved in the work of the process of changing things, that change did come over time. Change is not always easy. And sometimes there's some pretty significant conflict that happens before change takes place. However, change can be brought about. And in America right now, the great news is that a lot of the change can still happen on the legislative process. And one of the great benefits that came as a result of COVID, when places were shut down, and one of the early benefits we saw when parents were forced to homeschool their children, and for many parents for the first time, they began seeing what their kids were learning, or in some cases, what they weren't learning. And it raised a lot of ire and a lot of concern for parents. And so we have seen parents get involved in school boards, and now parents running for school board. And we've seen things happening where even in city council or mayoral races, I would argue that most people of America probably didn't even know who their mayor was. It's forced people's eyes to be open to a new level, and now people are getting involved. And this is one of the realities as we are looking at our states and asking the question, you know, what can my state do, or how can we get involved in my state to make sure that we're doing the right thing? Well, you can get involved in the legislative process. You can contact your state legislature, find out who's running, find out who's on the ballot. That a lot of states still have primaries coming up. We have general elections coming up this fall, where we can start electing the people who will fight for these God-given rights, fight for these biblical principles to promote the right kind of legislation. One of the things the Bible tells us is not only that when the godly are in authority, the people rejoice, but the Bible also tells us that righteousness is what exalts a nation. America has not always been a godly nation. We've not always had godly leaders. In fact, we've had some pretty ungodly leaders and done some pretty ungodly things on multiple occasions. But where our nation has been unique is our nation has always had a core of Christians that whenever there was evil happening, it was always Christians. It was always people in the church who stood up and opposed that evil. And that's why America has consistently corrected her evils. And to speak, we've corrected them historically faster than nearly any other nation in the world. Where we have fallen significantly behind would be, for example, the issue of abortion, where we are one of the only nations in the world that allows third trimester abortion. But I am excited for the time we're living in, because I do think that God is opening people's eyes. I think it's the foundation of a great awakening. So I'm excited as a Christian to see what God's going to do in the future.
That concludes our program today. You can catch the complete conversation of Eric Metaxas with Tim Barton at ChristianOutlook.com. While you're at ChristianOutlook.com, take a moment to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play, and never miss these and other great conversations. Thanks for joining us. Our program has been brought to you in part through a partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers David Passan, Tim Gantner, Michael Cook, and Nicholas Malone, I'm Kevin McCullough. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook. So she